Translation: when the ball leaped from her hand and fell at a distance, the woman began to follow it. But as Lord Shiva observed these activities, a breeze suddenly blew away the fine dress and belt that covered her. Thus Lord Shiva saw the woman, every part of whose body was beautifully formed, and the beautiful woman also looked at him. Therefore, thinking that she was attracted to him, Lord Shiva became very much attracted to her. Purport: Lord Shiva was observing every part of the woman's body, and she was also glancing at him with restless eyes. Thus Lord Shiva thought that she was also attracted to him, and now he wanted to touch her. So here the girl, if she was, you know, she's playing with the ball and she's minding her own business. And, you know, in the process then her clothes blew off. And then if she noticed someone was looking, then naturally she would be disturbed. She would not be very pleased. You know, she would try to move out of the way or something. Or she would give looks that were not favorable. But here, then, because she looked at him, and then he thought she was attracted to him. She is, you know, in this way, how you say, herself has been basically offered for him to look at. So then, and she is looking at him, so naturally he thinks she is attracted to him. So then that makes, you know, makes one more bold, one more, how you say, more confident that something is, some relationship is here. So then one moves forward with this. Otherwise, if one is not sure, then one is not confident. So there must be confidence to do an activity. You know, when there's a need, then one can perform an activity. But if that need is not there, then one is just being attracted, then there's no activity. You may be attracted, but nothing happens. But here you can see is, he's become very much attracted for her at this point. So this we can see is the process. He's first seeing, now he's become very much attracted. So attraction now is complete. So then now it's just a matter of going to the next step of desire, or need, so then there's a goal that he wants to go near. Like that. So he says here, he was attracted and now he wanted to touch her. So then this attraction has become deep enough that now he wants to go near. Okay, next text 25. Lord Shiva, his good sense taken away by the woman because of lusty desires to enjoy with her, became so mad for her that even in the presence of Bhavani, he did not hesitate to approach her. The beautiful woman was already naked, and when she saw Lord Shiva coming towards her, she became extremely bashful. Thus she kept smiling, but she hid herself among the trees and did not stand in one place. His senses being agitated, Lord Shiva, victimized by lusty desires, began to follow her, just as a lusty elephant follows a she-elephant. After following her with great speed, Lord Shiva caught her by the braid of her hair and dragged her near him. Although she was unwilling, he embraced her with his arms. Being embraced by Lord Shiva like a female elephant embraced by a male, the woman, whose hair was scattered, swirled like a snake. O king, this woman, who had large, high hips, was a woman of Yoga Maya presented by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. She released herself somehow or another from the fond embrace of Lord Shiva's arms and ran away. As if harassed by an enemy in the form of lusty desires, Lord Shiva followed the path of Lord Vishnu, who acts very wonderfully and who was taken the form and who had taken the form of Mohini. Purport: Lord Shiva cannot be victimized by Maya. Therefore, it is to be understood that Lord Shiva is being thus harassed by Lord Vishnu's internal potency. Lord Shiva can perform many wonderful activities through his various potencies. Parasya Shaktir Vividhaya Shuryate Sabhaviki Jnana Bala Kriya Cha, Sreta Swara Upanishad 6.8. The Supreme Lord has various potencies by which he can act very efficiently. To do anything expertly, he doesn't even need to contemplate. Since Lord Shiva is being harassed by the woman, it is to be understood that this was being done not by a woman, but by Lord Vishnu himself. So Vishnu, Shiva, he is the Lord of the material energy, so he cannot be victimized by the material energy. Because he being in control, then he cannot overcome him. What we see here is that he is being victimized. So then we can understand is that the Lord, by his many various potencies, through that then he is doing all this to Lord Shiva. He was being harassed in this way. So it's understood that it's the energy that is the attraction, not actually the form. The form is a manifestation of the potency. It is not the potency itself. So in the spiritual realm, the form and the potency and the mood, then they all are perfectly matched. But in the material world, then they are separate things. So we can see here is this form was Yogamaya. So then it is the Lord had taken this form. But it is the potency that has attracted him. Because otherwise the form of a woman is not something to attract and bewilder Lord Shiva. So that is something to be understood, is in this world, whatever is attracting us, whatever is we find to be necessary and important on the material platform, the thing itself is not actually has anything to do with our attraction. What is the attraction is caused because of the Lord's potency, the Lord's maya. Because of that, then we are attracted to something. We want something, so then the Lord arranges that we will find what we're looking for in a particular object. And then being attracted by that object, we will think that object is the source of our and cause of our attraction. But factually, it has nothing to do with that attraction or cause of this attraction. So this is the principle that is being brought out here, is that ourselves also we can understand in this world that we're attracted to things and have great interest or need for those things, but actually there isn't. That's why we can call it maya, because the thing itself is not what's necessary. It's the potency behind it. Of course, being caught up in it, we may not see that, or generally we don't see it. So when people say, this is maya, then we say, no, you don't understand, like that. But it's we're the one that doesn't understand, because the thing that we say we're attracted to, we're not attracted to. We're attracted to the potency that has been imbued in within it. And so that is the Lord's potency. So factually, we're being attracted by Krishna, but we don't know it's Krishna. We don't know it's his potencies. We think that it's the item that we're looking at, you know, that is made of the material elements. So that is what we, or, you know, let alone these higher powers of the Lord, just the lower powers, we think we're attracted by the beauty of the person, but actually we're attracted by the subtle body. You know, a woman, if she wants to be attractive, looks attractive. She doesn't want to be attractive, she doesn't look attractive. So if a woman looks attractive, it's because she wants to be attractive. So it's the subtle body that actually is what is attractive. So, and that's still material elements. So we're even mistaking the beauty of the body when it's actually the beauty of the subtle body. But that has been empowered by then even higher forces. And so all that's coming through, and then we're so foolish we think it's the gross external form. So here, another point is that Krishna is so expert he doesn't even need to contemplate. So that was just part of the pastime, that he was thinking how he's going to catch Shiva. So it's not that he's bewildered how he's going to do it. He's just thinking he's going to do it in this way. So before, then when he was contemplating how to do this, then it's actually he's thinking, I will do it in this way, and thinking of that, it was giving him some pleasure, so he was smiling. But here Prabhupada points out, he doesn't even have to think about it. It's not, there's an obstacle, there's never any obstacle for him. Just whatever he wants, it's done. Like that. Any questions on any of this so far? Okay. Text 32. Just as a maddened bull elephant follows a female elephant who is able to conceive pregnancy, Lord Shiva followed the beautiful woman and discharged semen, even though his discharge of semen never goes in vain. O King, wheresoever on the surface of the globe fell the semen of the great personality of Lord Shiva, mines of gold and silver later appeared. Purport. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments that those who seek gold and silver can worship Lord Shiva for material opulences. Lord Shiva lives under a bael tree and does not even construct a house in which to dwell. But although he is apparently poverty-stricken, his devotees are sometimes opulently endowed with large quantities of silver and gold. Maharaj Parikit later asks about this, and Sukadev Goswami replies. It means that those who are materialistic, those who they want wealth, then by worship of Lord Shiva, since he is the cause of that wealth, he is the origin of that wealth, and by his grace one can get such wealth. So even though he is poverty stricken, he lives under a tree, he doesn't need this wealth, it's all come from him, so but he does not require it, he is self-satisfied. So he lives under this bael tree. And then under this, then he is very satisfied, very happy. But those who are, it is very interesting, is those who, this comes up later, the discussion as Parikit Maharaj asks, is how is it that Lord Shiva lives under a bael tree, he has nothing, but his devotees who worship him are very rich, while Lord Vishnu, who is the Lord of all opulence and has unlimited opulence, his devotees are very poor. So then this is explained later, is that Lord Vishnu, because Lord Shiva, you approach him for benediction and he gives that. Lord Vishnu, though, by that benediction you get caught up in this world. So therefore Krishna, as Hari, takes things away from his devotees, and that liberates them from the material world, while Lord Shiva, he gives whatever the devotees want, but that keeps them bound in this material world. It says that once Lord Shiva, because he was sitting under this tree with his wife, and he was thinking, you know, it's, you know, nice, you know, the generally wives like houses, you know, like that. Generally most people have houses because of their wives. So then he built a house, a nice house, and, you know, outfitted it with every, you know, possible necessity that one would want. And then after doing this, then he had a Griha Pravesh ceremony like this, and invited all the demigods and the sages and Brahmins and all that, and they had a big program. And then he started giving in charity to everybody like this, and he gave away all his wealth. It still wasn't enough. He gave away all his furniture until finally all that was left was the house, and he gave that away. And then, ceremony being completed, he went back and sat under his bael tree. So, like that. So, he doesn't bother constructing houses. Any questions on this? Text 34. Following Mohini, Lord Shiva went everywhere, near the shores of the rivers and lakes, near the mountains, near the forests, near the gardens, and wherever lived great sages. Purport. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur remarks that Mohini Murti dragged Lord Shiva to so many places, especially to where the great sages lived, to instruct the sages that their Lord Shiva had become mad for a beautiful woman. Thus, although they were all great sages and saintly persons, they should not think themselves free, but should remain extremely cautious about beautiful women. No one should think himself liberated in the presence of a beautiful woman. The Shastras enjoin, Matra svasra duhritra va navivitashano bhavet balavan indriya gramo vidvamsam apikarishati. One should not stay in a solitary place with a woman, even if she be his mother, sister, or daughter. For the senses are so uncontrollably powerful that in the presence of a woman one may become agitated, even if he is very learned and advanced. Bhagavatam 9:19-17. So this is a principle that is given in the Dharma Shastras. Manu makes this point, is that the intelligent person will not be alone with any woman, even though it's maybe his mother, his sister, his daughter. Because the senses may become disturbed, may become agitated. So the Lord wanted to make this point to the sages, because otherwise the sages are very powerful by their austerities. They become in control of their senses, and they may become very proud of this, and in this way they may become lax. So then they may not be so careful in the presence of women. So then here we see is that they must be cautious, because if Lord Shiva is bewildered by the form of a beautiful woman, then let alone these sages who are worshipping Lord Shiva. So they must also be very, very careful in this connection.
So they were...
Yeah, so Krishna, whatever he does many, many things by it. So here, in this pastime, not only is he instructing Lord Shiva, but he is also, and others, according to his position, as supreme, more than, you know, above Lord Shiva, but also instructing these sages that they also have to be very, very careful in the performance of their duties, and that they cannot be neglectful. They must always be cautious. Any questions on this?
Maharaj, we hear this warning frequently. I was just thinking that in modern society, obviously people have no concept like that, but it's not necessarily the case that everyone who is even quite somewhat flirtatious, maybe in a certain social circumstance, is necessarily going to pursue that fully. There may be people, I mean, obviously there are many people who are completely uncontrolled, but there are others also who may remain faithful to their spouse, at least in terms of actual sexual intercourse, but they may still be quite, you know, flirtatious, and so therefore there must be some kind of control possible, even though they have that sort of contact. So I just wonder.
Two points. One, 70% of all sexual abuse to girls comes from close family members. Just we don't hear about it. Then another aspect is, see, here we're talking about human society. So in human society, then all forms of sex life are avoided. So even laughing, joking with a woman, though it would not be considered in the modern scenario to be, it would be considered perfectly innocent. But that's still considered a form of sex life, you know, because one is enjoying the interaction, the you know, being, there's much happening in the way of the exchange of energies, the mind, the potencies that are there, things are happening there. So that also, so looking at, means if somebody's sitting at a party and ogling at a girl, that's perfectly normal. It means nowadays we see especially the sunglasses and that, they're designed so you can look at people without them seeing you. Previously, you know, that's the way they're made. You know, they close all the way around, or they're reflective, or like that. You see, original sunglasses, when they came out, you know, and whatever it was, in the 40s, 50s, like this, you could see through them. You could see the person's eyes. You could see where they're looking. Because all it is a tint, just a slightly cut the reflection of the sun. But now they're made very dark. They wrap around. They're reflective. They're, you know, in some way, so you can't tell where they're looking. So the modern profile is you look very cool, like, you know, you're completely in control and unagitated by what's going on, at the same time as you're looking at whatever you can, you know, find to look at. So it's considered perfectly normal. So that first stage, the second stage of joking with them like that, even it's not considered bad touching. You know, somebody says something, makes a joke, and the woman, you know, kind of lightly slaps the man on the shoulder. It's considered perfectly fine. Like that, you know. So then I remember someone was telling me that that was even going on in our community of devotees with one sannyasi who fell down. He used to counsel the different devotees and all that. So he'd get quite close, and so then the women would deal with him so lightly that they would even touch him like that. You know, so no wonder that then later on this person fell away. So these levels are considered fairly nice. So basically, means up to the point of, means if they start actually seriously touching each other, then that's considered getting serious, but not serious. So actually only the eighth stage of all the eight kinds of sex is considered sex in the modern society. You know, kissing, fondling is not considered sex really. So therefore the first six, if they're done, is no problem at all. The seventh is okay as long as no one else is going to get disturbed by it, like that. But the eighth, then that's considered, okay, that may be proper or not. So it's not a proper understanding of what. So we're saying that they're not involved in sex, but they're very much involved. That's another point. And then a third point is that someone who is uncontrolled, therefore they're always agitated. So therefore a little bit of agitation is not going to seemingly bother them because they're already agitated. You know, like if you have water that's agitated and you bother, like if there's a stream running and you stick your hand in it, go like this, you know, you say nothing happened. Or if you go to a very calm lake and you move your hand like that, it'll create ripples across the whole lake. So that will be the difference, is you won't see it. Nowadays, the persons are so agitated and they're so weak from that agitation that you don't notice any difference like that. It has to get very severe. It means that's what we were mentioning before, is the subtleties of womanhood don't even aren't even noticed by the men. You have to be quite gross. A woman would have to be quite gross, not only in her dress, but also in her behavior. Even if she dressed, if a girl dressed in some of these very, daring dresses nowadays, but was very, very shy and bashful, she might be noticed by a few more refined persons, but the others probably wouldn't notice at all. So it's that what they wear and how they wear it, then they get noticed. Like that. Otherwise, the men are so dull these days. You know, dull from all angles, you know. So therefore, then, you know, this much has to be done to catch their attention. But someone who is self-controlled and all that, then they will catch any aspect that is connected with this sex. So even just the slightest little things, then will create a disturbance. And the disturbance we might find is more violent, like that, because of its suddenness. Then we find that the reaction is more bewildering, like that. But at the same time, as we find, is because of that self-control, then they can bring it back into control, or after the fact, then they can get things back together. But while those persons that are always bewildered, they remain bewildered before sex, during sex, and after sex. Well, those who are self-controlled, then before and after, they won't be bewildered, but during they may be. Like that. Is that Nikani? Yes.
If you're preaching all these two vehicles, and you have a front child, should you be avoiding women? Or, like, you want to give your message to everyone?
Point is, it's not, we only have to understand it's not our mercy, it's Krishna's mercy. And then the Madhyama distinguishes between who is worth giving that mercy to and who's not, who can take that mercy and who won't. So then you have to judge accordingly, you know. So it's who can accept that mercy, that person is approached. Those who are not, they're not approached, you know, those who are inimical, just like the men. The question generally doesn't come up among the men. You know, do I approach all the men? You know, if you see someone who, you know, by their behavior, by their dress, you know, by their attitude, doesn't seem to be worth giving trying, then we'll generally avoid. We will, since we don't have so much time, then there's so many people, you'll choose someone who is going to be seemingly a better,
prospect?
Yeah, prospect, but I was thinking a less kind of like mercenary term.
Recipient,
but then also there's one gentler that they would be able to appreciate. You know, they would be able to respond properly to it like that. It means the others are also true, but I'm just saying that this is a... So the same way is also with women, that it's not how well they're dressed and how scantily they're dressed and how much they're presenting themselves that they makes them more seemingly more you know, a proper recipient. But that's the Maya. Means even amongst women that works. A very well-dressed, well-behaved woman, then even amongst other women, then she's respected. Like that. It doesn't matter what her motive is, because the whole point is women become attractive in that when they put on that attraction. It's not natural. It's they create that. You know? That's created. So then, It's just understood that the whole environment is going to be a created environment. So therefore we see is when Mother Jashoda and all the others were sitting with Krishna, then when Putana came, dressed very beautifully and behaving in a very, you know, very fine way, high class way, then everybody was immediately attracted by her, you know, beauty and all that, and thought, here's a very, you know, pious, high class person. Must be even a demigod, who is demigoddess, who's come to see Krishna because he's so wonderful. So then they all let her in. So that's the qualification, basically, of a woman. A woman, if she's dressed well, behaves well, she can get in anywhere in the world, at any level of social strata, like that. Men, it's different. You know. So one has to be a little careful of that. One has to see that the attitude would be for reciprocation of taking a book or, you know, acknowledging the preaching rather than just, you know, not. That should be what's there, you know. And if it is, then one can give, but one has to then be very careful that one can understand that the potencies that that woman carries is coming from Krishna. So if one is able to see that, there's no problem. If one thinks it's the woman who's beautiful, then one might be careful. Right? The principle is that you're trying to get to the stage where the senses are not disturbed, even in the presence of sense objects. But to get to that position, then one must practice that outside of, away from sense objects. Like that. Does that make sense? So one has to see one's own, you know, situation and then apply it.
Now in the scriptures, the general principle. So it's possible that in a straight case, somebody is not educated, but this is meant for in terms of such an overall situation. So we can't interpret everything according to, you know, black and white. It's a possibility here and there, you know, if it's not as serious. But the general principle remains true.
Mm.
That's true.
Yes.
So what the scripture says, you know, and then we have to accept that generally it is true. You know,
yeah.
It's applicable to everyone, and there's no exception.
Yeah.
But there may be an exception here and there, that according to the circumstances we can accept that.
Mm. Yes, that's why the scriptures then establish then a lifestyle that matches these. So therefore then all these situations, then one would, you know, generally when there's daughters, then there's mothers. When there's mothers, then there's, you know, wives and other members of the family. So generally there would, you know, be created that there would always be opportunity, that there's always someone around. The modern situation doesn't always facilitate that. But the principle should always be acknowledged and followed. Even if one is not, it's the social structure. Krishna likes it this way. It's just the way he wants it to be. Because, I say, the conjugal rasa is only with wife. So therefore, it shouldn't be there. Because all of them are potential. The mother and the daughter and the sister potentially can conceive children. So therefore, that rasa could take place there, and it shouldn't. So therefore, one avoids those situations like that.
What if a devotee in authority, you know, a teacher has that attraction for some students or something? What happens? How do they deal with that when that person is supposed to be in authority, you know, teaching them and is actually representing Krishna, but there's something there, you know, there's kind of some confusion there. Could you say something about that?
Both sides are there. One is that the person in the authority should see that they're not in situations where they get attracted, you know, so they shouldn't discuss with them alone, you know, or, you know, whatever, or spend too much time looking at them or, you know, in any way dealing that may cause problem. But at the same time, is the girls have to also learn to be able to distinguish between various kinds of energies that they use. Problem is the modern energy from when you're generally quite young, 6, 8 years old, one is taught how to project energy to attract attention. You know, so even now, I don't know if it's, you know, still around now, but I remember before, some years back, it was very popular to the, you know, 7, 8, 9 year old girls, they would always wear these skin tight, synthetic clothes. Like that. That was considered, you know, the nice thing for these girls to wear. So, and generally those kind of clothes would only be worn by the most outrageous, you know, unwholesome women. You know. But somehow or another it's cool on, you know, 7, 8 year old girls. So they develop that mood though they're so young. So many times I've seen is the girls don't know, many girls don't even know that they have energies they can turn on and off. They're completely unaware. Many are aware, so they understand that in these situations they should just turn off the energies. But some are totally unaware. They don't know. They've been so conditioned to always have those energies on that even when they're in the presence of, you know, others who they shouldn't be using those for, in other words, except for the husband at intimate moments, they just are always projecting attractive energy. Because if the girl turns those energies off, she's not attractive. She becomes very plain. You know, when we say someone's plain Jane, it's because she doesn't project any energies. Even a girl who is physically unattractive, if she projects those energies, will be attractive. You know, so the physical qualifications are only part of the attractive feature. More important is the subtle body. So if the girl doesn't know, so that's an important thing. Is the women have to be aware and make each other aware. Those who are authorities amongst the women must train the younger girls what is appropriate and what is not. Then also, so then they know how to sit, how to dress, how to behave, how to interact, you know, like that. Because otherwise, many times, you know, that they talk, they're asking questions, you know, and they, you know, giggle so much and bat their eyelashes and do all kinds of funny things and look bashful and do all these, you know, things. All they're doing is asking a question. You know, they don't have to do those things. You know, so it goes both ways. Is that women are protected first and foremost by women themselves. Then secondly, then a woman who is able to protect herself then can be given the support of protection by men. But a woman who can't protect herself then cannot be, even the most expert and well-wishing men can't protect her. So it starts from there. You know, means the person who fire is in the hands of, it's their responsibility to see that it doesn't burn down the forest. Right? So therefore, if they keep the fire in control, then that will do so much. Means nowadays, what is it? Means the men are absorbed in this and that. They'd like the, of course, they're always, you know, open for being attracted to women. But we see is that's being projected practically every billboard. You can't sell anything, you know. You can't even sell, nothing. The girl has to be half-dressed or undressed, you know. I mean, it used to be it was, you know, it just you had a well-dressed woman and it would sell an item. But now she has to be undressed to sell it. You know, you can't sell a can of baked beans unless she's half-naked, you know. It's like, it's a problem. So therefore, then there's so much disturbance. So if this was all pulled back, you would see the society just quiet down immediately. The media would just quiet down. You know? So that's one half, much of the time. You know, so therefore both. The man has to be intelligent to see what is going on and not put himself in situations that will create agitation. And then the women must understand their role in controlling these potencies and therefore not let situations come up. You know, I've heard it many times. A wife of one person whose husband is starting to be attracted by another, she blames the woman, not the husband. Because she knows the potency of women. So she knows that the other woman has been doing this, this, and these aren't proper. So therefore now she's attracted. Because they know. Women know the weakness of men. So they know if they do these certain things, you'll catch their attention. So this woman did it, she shouldn't have done it. So therefore, even amongst there, it's understood that there is some responsibility on that side. Does that make some sense? Yes.
In a situation like that, it would be quite evident that the male also would have had a knocker somewhere.
Of course.
The male can at any stage reject the offer, basically, and because you need both parties to make it happen, then...
Yeah, but he has to reject early enough, and the offer can't be very powerful. See, the point is that if the offer goes beyond his potency to reject, then he's caught. So that's the thing, is he has to understand that there is something wrong, or that the energy level is too high, and so therefore somehow or another avoid going near it before it happens, you know, because you can sense beforehand. But if the anarthists are too strong, one doesn't mind being attracted, so therefore one will put oneself in a compromised position. The girls also then have to know. So this, you know, how you say it? You know, but both sides have to be very careful. Yes?
Sometimes, particularly the yogis, those who achieve the considerable level of sense control, they say that sexual attraction is not the highest temptation.
Not the highest?
It's not the highest temptation.
No, it's not. Being God is a little higher than that.
Yeah, and can you extend a bit more on another aspect of illusion? Usually we're saying that this attraction to male beauty is the essence of the illusion, but another aspect of illusion.
Well, see, as you have the specific principle and then the general principle. It means the general principle or how you say it, specific principle is that you are the enjoyer, controller and enjoyer. So therefore, then you focus on a, you know, one woman or some group of women, or you know, whatever woman you can, you know, whatever it is, get the association of. But then, so that is the, you know, the highest basic principle for those who are interested in sense gratification. So that means from Indra on down, from Indra's planet down, that will be. But from Indra's planet to Satyaloka, then it's more that you are in control of the energy. So therefore, then they will generally, in a subtle way, bring themselves to the level of Lord Shiva. So they're not interested in controlling and enjoying this woman, because that is, you know, they understand you're being controlled. They are above, they are in control of the material energy. So that puts them in the position of Lord Shiva. Like that. Technically, they don't, if you talk to them, most of them won't realize this. But that's what it puts, the position it puts them in. So then they enjoy on a bigger platform, is that, you know, all things, you know, women, opulence, it's all under one's control. So then there's a feeling of that. And then the final point is that I am God. Like that. Because the yogis, they know Vishnu. Like that. The impersonalists don't. They don't know the form of the Lord. So they know the form. And so they see the form and they consider that is me. So that's the last snare. You know, so for them, but this is for those who are beyond sexual attraction. But these are only happening after these powerful. When we talk about powerful yogis, we're only talking about the dhyan and samadhi. We're not talking about below that. Below that, we're not talking about powerful yogis. So until they've stopped, they can stop the life air and perform meditation. Only at that point, then we're talking about powerful yogis. Up to that point, we're not talking about powerful yogis. You know? So only those persons, they've controlled the senses, then they go beyond, so then they have the danger of thinking that they have come to that position like Shiva or Vishnu. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So in this age, you don't have to worry about powerful yogis. Right.
But still, you know, with this famous Russian Christian, how do you say it? Rasputin, everyone knows.
Yeah, Rasputin, but I don't think he was had
at the beginning,
a problem of not being able to control his senses.
I read his various books. He began as a quite a good monk, and he was in the pilgrimage, and he achieved a considerable level of sense control.
Yeah, considerable level, but the thing is you become proud of it. You become proud of your power, and so then power is then wielded, and then that means sense gratification. So the point is yes, he was quite controlled, so maybe he, you know, wasn't attracted to the local village wenches. But, you know, his thing was, he was having sex with the Tsar's wife. So, you know, it's that's, you know, pretty good buzz.
He already broke himself. But beginning was what he was wishing.
To do whatever they like. So as long as you appreciate what they do, and you can do what you want to do, and vice versa, then it's called compatibility. But if they didn't like what you did, or they weren't able to do what they wanted to do, then it's not considered compatible. So sex means exploiting the other person, you know, in the most, you know, how you say, intimate way. Like that. So that's there. So that control, that much, you know, control is then. So that's the founding principle of it. Like that. So it's how do you say? That's the difficulty, is that someone wants to if they have the mentality to control, sex is still underlying it, though it may be dormant or it may be manifest. So those who are karmis, it's manifest. For those who are jnanis and yogis, it's dormant. But in any case, they want to control and enjoy in some way.
You were saying that nowadays, if you woman behaves that in a strange manner, no man notice her. And if
not strange. I didn't say strange. I said just a natural, feminine, reserved way. You know, that's cultured. Then, except for a cultured man, no one would notice. Oh, I guess maybe that is strange these days. Excuse me. Sorry.
Sorry. I said restrained.
Oh, restrained. I thought you said strange. Yes, it is strange if the girl is restrained these days.
I was thinking about an analogy that if you can try in the West, please, if you try to preach in a sort of a very modest, timid way, so to achieve something, you have to be attractive, very confident.
There's different kinds of attraction. These little girls, are they attractive? Yeah, but are they sexually attractive? So then those energies are still there. You understand? So it means whatever energies you've used in your life, they're still there.
It means you have aspects of material energy which is not sexually.
Because of the mixing of it, see, women by nature are sensual. But nowadays they've mixed sexual with it. So anything sensual automatically is given the connotation of sexual. But in the Vedic sense, women's, their dealings will be sensual, but it won't be sexual. So because it's not sexual, it has the innocence to it. Like that. So then, like little girls, though they're attractive, it doesn't arouse sexuality. Then in the same way, as that's how it would be in the Vedic culture. You know, they would still, you know, and they would be able to move and do whatever they do and get everything done. It means a little girl comes up to you, wants to talk to you, you have her attention immediately. You know, same way with a young boy. They want to come up and talk to you, they have your attention. So attractiveness doesn't have to be what is considered modern. The modern is basically Shudra's attraction. This sitting around, cool, tough, you know, nobody can bother you. You want to see this in its pure state. You know, pure unalloyed coolness. Go to Vrindavan, watch one of the monkeys sitting on the wall. You look at them, they look away, as if you're not there, you know, do something else, scratch, you know, pick something. You don't get anyone more cool than them. So that's all it is. This modern coolness is just a Shudra's total self-centered focus on themselves, you know. So you can see it, the exact moods, the looks, the movements, you can see it in the monkeys when they, it's exact. You know. That's what's so amazing. It's just, it's there. And then, but all you'd have to do is put a pair of sunglasses and a trench coat on them, and then they would be the star in any movie nowadays. You know, of course, you have to work a little bit on the way they walk. You know, there is a problem. But if you could overcome that, then you know you'd have a star. So that's all it is. Is that what is considered properly social is then established nowadays by the shooters, by the actors. But the problem is then it's not directed by Shastra. Previously, actors were always there. They do dramas, but they would act, you know, according to the part they were playing. If they were playing a Brahmin, they would act like a Brahmin. If they're playing a Kshatriya, they would act like a Kshatriya. If it's a demigod, they would act like a demigod. If it's a Shudra, they'd act like a Shudra. So then, you could tell the difference. But nowadays, you know, what's considered good is basically just his shudra character, shudra, you know, interests and abilities and movements and all this kind of stuff. So it's not gentle, it's not high class, you know. So that, unfortunately, that's then, and then people pick that up. You know, the women pick it up, the men pick it up, and then you have a whole society of cool people. Okay. Something else?
Should we do anything about things like this? My daughter, is what she was watching. She watches some like witches fighting demons, things like that. It's, you know, pretty innocent in a way, not really. But and then just I've been doing the iron with her, and then just something came on that advertises Big Brother, and it's like a lot of people around society watch this, and it's X rated. People have got no clothes on, and it's just. But it's so mundane and boring because it's all to do with in a house. It seems to be in a house. I don't know, I haven't watched it, but it seems to be in a house. But it seems, should we ring up and complain? Should we say, why, you know, why are we, you know, it's Channel 7, we've got Jeff Newman, he does the wedding, he's supposed to be a respectful person. Should we ring up and say that we don't want our kids watching this kind of stuff? Should we make a stand?
You can try. I mean, it's even better is probably not to be watching it in the first place. You know, go down to the pub, then you can't afterwards go to the head of the pub and complain, how come everyone here, you know, doesn't behave right, and, you know, they always try to come up and start up a conversation, and now and again there's big fights, you know.
Yes. No, I'm thinking for like a 15-year-old, you know, my daughter's 15, I'm 16, so, and she's pretty naive. So it's...
In one way. It means you have to understand, as soon as they hit puberty, they're not girls, they're women. You have girl, woman. That's how it works. Boys, you have boy, punk, man. But the girls, you don't have that middle part. They immediately go from girl to woman. So they're naive on one thing, means on detail, but not in principle. You know, at 15, I'm sure she's already worked out what her house will look like, you know, this, that, what kind of, you know, arrangements. How many kids? She's, you know. That's why you have to, in the Vedic system, there's generally, you know, an ideal or an average of 10-year difference in age. Because the girl starts thinking about, you know, realities of life from 12, or the boy doesn't start until much later. So that way then, materially, they're kind of the same. You know, because during the punk time, they don't think about these things. See, the boy is with the girl. The boy is just thinking it's great fun. The girl is thinking about, you know, more serious things. You know, like that. So it means you can naive in the way of not knowing much, let's say, gross detail. Like that. And maybe naive in the way of she's still maybe pious feminine rather than going into impious feminine. It means he's still in the mood of, you know, emotion rather than senses. Means the point is they're going to move in one realm, is that you're either emotion is the main realm and the senses are connected to it, or the emotion realm of the senses and the emotions are connected to it. So if you can keep them in the realm of the emotions, it's good.
I've still got a TV in my room. My kids have, you know, watched videos. You watch videos, not now. She's turning on the TV. You know, before it was control, it was Peter Pan, or it was, you know.
But how long can you watch? How long can you watch Peter Pan? You know, it's like,
you know, yeah, but it was got control. But now it's moving out of where you can control.
It's just the way it is, you know.
So then we do rely just on Krishna's mercy and just keep praying. Is that all we can do in the religion?
It means the point is she's going to watch what is attractive to her. So the point is if it's attractive to her, then she's going to watch it. You know, if there's any way of discussing, is this actually worth watching? And then watch something else, you know, or do something else. I mean, it's not, it's life, how you say. There are some people who survive without a television. They're actually, there are karmis that won't have televisions in their homes. You know, it's not only devotees. There's probably more karmis that won't, by their own determination, have a television in their house, you know, than there are devotees that do have televisions that just say that they're just being normal. You know, this, like devotees say, it's, you know, not possible in this age to follow the Vedic culture. There's probably millions of people who are following it. You know, that we always must remember, there's 1 billion Indians living in India. Then you have the millions that live outside. You know, and to some degree or another, they're all following. So somehow or another, it's impossible for Westerners to conceive that it could be followed in this age, but there's hundreds of millions of people who are following it. Maybe not so well, but, you know, to some degree, someone's following this one, someone's following that one. So all elements of the Vedic culture are being followed. There are people that, exactly out of Manu Samhita as you read it, there are people today who are following it. And they're not just some weirdo little person. They're people who are, you know, headmasters of educational institutions and other things like this, big positions in India, and they're following. You know, we went around and discussed with these kind of people about the culture and everything like that. And what Prabhupada says about the four Aghata principles, it's just like there was no question that that wasn't followed. The idea of having sex not to conceive a child, to them it was just like the stupidest thing. That someone would think of using sex other than creating a child was just like inhuman. And this wasn't, they were putting on, this is a gut reaction. Because their training and their determination and understanding the shastras so strong. And it wasn't one, it was every person we met who was coming from a culture trained background. It wasn't like there was a mix, everyone. If there was any one point they all agreed on, it was that one point. Right? At the same time as we have devotees pushing the philosophy that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur and Srila Prabhupada started this. Before that, in the Vedic age, everyone just had sex like cats and dogs. You know? And here's people, they're not devotees, they're not Gaudiya Vaishnavas, they're not even Vaishnavas at all, they're just smartas who follow only the Veda. They don't accept other scriptures. And they're like that. Then the Sri Vaishnavas, the Madhvas, they're like that. And then the Gaudiyas, they're like that. But somehow or another, in the modern scenario, the, you know, especially the, you know, those in the West, they love to dream up their own religious process. It's a serious disease. You know? So therefore, it's, you have to see what, you know, environment you want to establish in your house if you're able to establish it. You know, point is, if you have some influence, then you can try to get them to a position that is, you know, proper. If you don't have the influence, then what can you do about it anyway? Does that make any sense? Or?
Yeah. It's like, you know, it's like actually, they say going cold turkey. It's like, you know, at onset you won't just pour water on the TV and say it blew up, you know. But then you've got, you know, I think, well, Jasmine will eventually, Mum says, oh, Jasmine will go and, you know, go to Peter's place, or she'll be out in the street, won't be at home. So it's a whole, you know, thing, at least the TV, or not the TV, but at least a video keeps her, you know, at home.
Means you establish whatever it is, but know whatever it is today, it'll be something else tomorrow. You know, then the next thing it's, well, better she's here with Peter than at Peter's house. You know, and then next it will be, well, better she's in the bedroom alone with Peter with the door locked than, you know, out on the street, you know, maybe with someone else. At least we know Peter doesn't have AIDS. You know? And then next is, well, at least we know Peter's the father. So it's just, this is, it's the modes of nature. You deal with them, you get what you want. So if that's what the mother wants, then great. It's, you know, there's, you know, cats and dogs are really popular these days. Everybody's got them.
But then, you find the person that, you know, it doesn't listen, you know, she doesn't listen, I can't reason with my daughter.
So then there's nothing you can do. So therefore you should detach yourself. You'd use this for, you know, you have a responsibility if they reciprocate. They don't reciprocate, you don't have a responsibility. So therefore, your business is to see that this isn't the ultimate purpose of your life. The ultimate purpose is to become detached from this world and go back to Godhead. You know? And if you're around, if they want to listen, great. And if they don't, then what you can do. But you have to focus on Krishna. That's where you should be focusing. You know? That's what the whole process is for. Because at some point it's going to burn you out. No matter how nice it is, it's going to be a inspiration for liberation. Right? Even Kardama and Devahuti. You know, you don't hear, it's perfect marriage. Perfect. But as soon as Kapila is ready to take responsibility for his mother, Kardama goes to the forest. Because whatever the situation, it brings about realization in the living entity's heart that this is not actually what I'm looking for. There's something higher. Therefore, no matter how nice the arrangements are, then there's still the, you know, going back to Godhead.
It's definitely, if you are serving Krishna directly, like, you know, if you're doing deity worship, if you're doing things that seem directly, you know, are related to the temple, it's a lot more satisfying, it's a lot more tangible, you know, the reciprocation is a lot more tangible. But when you're home and you're doing your duty, it doesn't feel very rewarding. Just do your duty. You know, you're doing it, but you're not sure. I'm going to show up, I'm pleasing Prabhupada, or, you know.
Point is, if you're getting results. If not, then, you know, instead of watching Big Brother, let them watch Big Brother, and you can be here at the Arctic. You know? It's probably more satisfying. You know, point is duty should get results also. You know, doing duty that doesn't get results is not means religion means what works. So if it's not working, then you can maybe understand maybe that isn't your duty, or it's only part of your duty. It's not your prime duty. Means if they're willing to take your direction and instruction, then teaching them is a major part of your duty. If they're absolutely not willing to listen at all to anything, you know, but at least they're, you know, happy to have you around, so then you know, just take advantage to, that's your place to stay, and you make your duty more here. Because if they're not getting results, it's just like if the sages, if the person's not interested to listen, you don't speak. And that's one of the principles. Is if someone doesn't want to hear, you don't speak to them. You don't preach to them. They're quiet. So even though the situation demands something being done and said, because no one's interested, therefore nothing's said. Because if you, by you saying it, nothing happens, then what's the use? Speech is for a purpose. It should have some results. If it gets no results, then what's the use?
If it causes a disturbance to them anyway, they get angry or...
Yeah, then what's the use? It means you don't preach to a fool. You know? So therefore, if you feel, I must do, then that means you're being maybe overbearing. You know, due to our own, we're thinking, yes, I am the one that knows, I will correct, I will do, but we're not getting the result. If you're getting the result, great. If you're not getting the result, what's the meaning?
They're young,
they are only young, and they're supposed to listen, but if they're not, what's the use?
You still give them a safe place to
I mean, so they're there, but the same, as long as there's limits. You might decide whether it's a limit when they bring all their friends home and they have an ecstasy party. Then you might decide that and do that without any clothes. Then you might decide, well, maybe that's stretching the limit. So you have to decide where your limit is. Because the point is they want to take advantage of the facilities, but if they don't want to reciprocate, then. So as long as they reciprocate, at least they appreciate it and they deal with you nicely, that's there. But if they don't take advice, then that's just, a problem.
I can see that for some of our congregation that have in that situation. But my daughter has defective intelligence. So mm-hmm. I have,
that's another thing.
But it's something,
It means these things are discussed with the mature members of the community who have experience and who have all these things. I mean, we're discussing here the philosophy of it, the principles of it, but the details of it, that you have to work out with the local devotees. That's what community's for. Like that. That's what it's for. It means your philosophical understanding and that has gotten in this place. But the details of application in your life, if you can't work it out, then you take advantage of those who are experienced and mature. Okay. Yes.
On the point of not speaking if someone's not willing to listen, if someone feels that it's my duty to say what's right, whether they listen or not, is that not correct?
Depends on the situation. Because if the person doesn't accept you as an authority, then what is the relationship? It means Vedic thing is there must be a relationship. Then speaking has some meaning. Even just in etiquette, let's say you don't really know the person or that, and you're talking and something comes up that you want to say something on, then you ask, do you mind if I'm frank? Or I could give you something you asked about, some of your experience. Do they want it first? If they want it, then you speak it. But if you just start speaking very frankly and you don't even hardly know the person, there's no relationship, then they'll go away with a bad impression. This person is, doesn't know how to behave. So the point is that one should be the authority of that person, but if they're not behaving, then one may give up that position, or one may not act, knowing that if it's a temporary manifestation of indiscipline, then that's one thing. But if it's the nature, then it's not done. That's why a teacher will not accept students except for those that they feel they can teach. So it depends on the character that they can work with. So if you can work with it, then you say. If you don't, then you're not supposed to say. That's the austerity of speech. Because if you speak and it gets no result, what's the use of it? You've spoken and it didn't improve the situation. Neither did they become more Krishna conscious, mm-hmm. and neither did it improve relationships. So then one has to be very, very careful to see. Like that. That's why these things have to be done from a very training, especially with children, from a very early age. It has to be done. Generally, modern society thinks that when there's a problem, then you should teach them. But the Vedic is you teach them knowing that if you don't teach them, the problem will arise. Like teaching character in children starts from as soon as they can understand what you're talking about. I mean, as soon as they understand speech, then you talk. So from 2-3 years old, you're training them in culture. What is proper, what's not proper. So things that they do that are not proper, you don't let them do it just because they're a kid. It's tolerated because they're a kid. You know they'll do it, but they're still, they're taught that it's not correct. And if they do it again, you teach them again. You keep going until they finally catch it. While an adult, you don't tolerate it so much. They should know better, or they're told once, and then they should respond. Kids may take longer, but they're taught. But many don't teach until it's too late. When they hit teenage, then they start teaching, but it's a little bit late. You know, like about 9 years late. You know? So they should already be trained and cultured and all that from an early age, either by directly telling or by stories. And the stories are more than keeping them entertained. The story you tell Ramayana, Mahabharata, one, it entertains them because it's a story, but it's full of culture. Culture, philosophy, etiquette, you know, all these, you know, religion. So the whole point is all those should be brought out. And then they know the story, and then in a situation that warrants someone else did something, you point out, see, just like, you know, this and that story, this happened, so therefore... You know, or it relates to them, and that, you know, in this story like that, and so, you know, somehow or another they have to be trained. And then it's good. So that's many times the problem is that if they're trained before, then when they're older, then it's easier. It means if you have a relationship, then you have influence. If you don't have a relationship, you have no influence. You know, some people buy just... If they respect authority, then even though you don't have a relationship, you have a relationship by position. Like, someone accepts authority, so therefore whoever's the temple president automatically has authority because they accept the principle of authority. But to work only on that is weak. The president or any position, the parent, the teacher, should have authority also in relationship. So if in the beginning you don't know the person, that will be where it will stand from. But then it has to develop that personally, then there's authority. Then there's some meaning. You know, then you can go deep, otherwise it will remain shallow.
Are there other situations? I mean, the situation is different. Mm-hmm. Somebody is cooking chapatis in the kitchen, and the fire is not proper, the door is not proper, and they are cooking the chapati. And you happen to pass that way and you saw that, you know, she doesn't know or he doesn't know. And you happen to say the fire is a bit too much, you know, maybe that. And then, you know, the person flares up inside, oh, who is he, boss, you know. And they get angry and they complain, oh, so and so is, you know, always telling you, the ordering you about, don't do like that. What can you do? You treat your mother, you are cooking for the Lord, you know. And it should be properly cooked, and you happen to be there, you just mentioned this thing, it will improve. And you are full of ego, you know, you don't want to listen, then later you complain. But it's not the fault of the person who is saying, you know, how good will it is. So all these things have to be taken according to time, place, and circumstances. There is no rigid law. That if they are not listening, you don't have to talk.
No, but at the same time as what has been the benefit of your talking. You were supposed to improve for the Lord. Now they're in a worse mood. They cook all the rest of the chapatis. Not only are they burnt, but they're in bad consciousness. Then they make politics. They make the whole temple turn it upside down. Well, if you hadn't said anything, then all that would have happened is the Lord gets some burnt chapatis.
No, not only today, tomorrow, the day after.
Yes, so therefore then you go to their authority. You go to the cook and say, hey, do you know that they're cooking burnt chapatis? And as long as they're in a proper mood, then they'll, oh, they didn't know. I thought they knew how to cook. Because maybe they're not there. They don't see that offering. They don't know it's burnt. If they don't listen, you go to the president. And if they don't listen, then, you know, then you got a problem. You know, so the point is that, means once you'll try, definitely, but if you see that the person has an attitude, because you expect, it's natural, if you know they don't know, you say something, it's natural, because it's but if you see that this person has an attitude, then it's better not to say anything. Yeah, then you go to their authorities. And if that doesn't work, then, you know, the Lord, if he likes burnt chapatis, then he'll arrange that person keeps cooking.
Well, he did arrange in one day, and that didn't work. Then he didn't make another review. Now, why would he keep accepting the burnt chapatis, half-cooked chapatis?
Yeah, it means, like you say, it's time, place, and circumstance, yeah. So you have to see. But one also has to see, you know, the size. If it's not going to work, why bother? You know, because then you're wasting Krishna's time. It just creates a bad atmosphere. Same time as it's not beneficial for the other parties. But if you can't have influence, then... You know, it's like preaching to the faithless. They're faithless that you know what is a chapati. So therefore, to preach to them would be preaching to the faithless.
Sometimes you see the wrong thing happening, you still feel morally bound, you know. You say and express yourself, he doesn't want it,
yeah, it means as long as the whole rest of it you can accommodate, that they'll make politics against you and the whole temple, though they don't know what is a chapati, are telling you, who are from a culture of chapatis, what is a chapati. You know, then if you can tolerate that, then no problem. Means, in other words, one has to see the bigger picture. That then you can't complain about the others. It means if you tell a fool something, they're going to get upset. In the Vedas, it's said that a fool comes with their ideas, and if you try to explain to them they're wrong, it creates so much problem, you'll waste so much time trying to explain it. Well, if you just say, yes, great idea, then they'll go away happy. You've gotten rid of the situation in 30 seconds, and then you do whatever you want to do. You know? And then they'll come later, oh, you didn't do it? This was just like this. So, you know, you should do like this. Oh, great idea. Then they'll go away, and then you just go on. So that's... It's not nice, but that's the way you have to deal with a fool. It's just the way it is. So then, you know, so therefore one considers what is best, you know, is that if there's a chance that you'll keep saying and they'll catch it one of these days, then it's worth it. But if you can see it's a lost cause and it only creates problem, then what to do?
Place and circumstance
for us to
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And what is the, we know that humility is important for progress and spirituality.
How can we distinguish between humility and
self-humiliation? One is goodness and one is ignorance. So if inspiration is created, it's humility. If you lose inspiration, then it's ignorance. Then it's self-humiliation. Because then that means self-humiliation means it's... See, humility means you're being humble. Self-humility means self, you know, what do you call it? Then you are thinking the gross and subtle body is yourself, and then you are humiliating that. You understand? There's a difference. Humble is just, it's the fact. So therefore, you just accept that and move on. You take the humble position. But the other one is then, it's actually self-centered. The other one's not self-centered. It's just seeing the you are part of a situation. So in this situation, you should be humble. And you take all these elements and humility is required. The other is, I'm the center of the whole thing, but I'm useless.
You can see quite often the devotees, when they attempt to sort of achieve humility, they fall in that way.
Yeah, because
they're disabling themselves.
Yeah, but it's...
No self-confidence, no nothing.
Yeah. But the point is we're not you're not looking for self-confidence, but you're not looking for is that the self may be able to do things, but it's Krishna's potency. This conditioned nature has the ability to do something. You know, that's its nature. You'll try to do it. Can you cook? Yes, we can try our best. You may be considered the best cook. So conditioned nature is to cook, but same time as that potency still is coming from Krishna. If he wants, it can work and not work. So therefore, yes, we'll do our best. So you endeavor with that confidence, because you know it's Krishna's and it's Krishna's service. And if he wants, it'll come out nice. And if he doesn't want, he wants you to be humiliated, he will be. You know, it's Krishna. It's like here, like at the end, you know, Shiva's not feeling really bad and keeping his head down and can't look at his wife or anybody like that, because he knows it's Krishna's potency. And Krishna was able to overpower him. No one can overpower him. No one in that assembly can overpower him, but Krishna can. So, you know, therefore, it's different. You have to see that, yeah. Also, if you're working on qualities more than abilities, you know, in the prayers of the Acharyas, they're not talking about abilities, they're talking about qualities. I'm full of lust, greed, I'm very motivated, this, that. They're not going, I'm such a terrible kirtan leader, I can't cook, I can't dress properly. That's not what's in the prayers. If you study the songs, you'll see that. So therefore, those things, it's just, you know, you do your best.
How we can understand yogis on such levels where they really have all these qualities, they think about themselves as devoid of?
Because they will interpret it like that. It may have the external symptom like that, though it doesn't have the internal symptom. Right? Like Madhavendra Puri wants to taste the sweet rice. It has the external symptom of somebody who wants to eat something before the offering. But internally it doesn't. So they just take the externals. So therefore even an advanced devotee will find faults in himself.
Yeah, I heard another answer that they see the greatness of Krishna and compare to Krishna.
That's another way of looking at it. That's both.
They easily can accept the low position, but they express him more than anyone. But us, it's not true. Obviously,
because we're proud. We're proud. So even though we have worse qualities than what they're describing, we think it's not so bad. Well, they see it as not good.
How they can perceive being much more advanced than others, they can perceive themselves. Whoa.
That we explained when you first asked the question. See, is one, it's a very important principle that one thing, it's just like, okay, 4 and 4 equals what? Okay, 6 and 2 equals what? What about 7 and 1? 5 and 3? Okay, now for 4 and 4 to be 8, does that mean all the other number calculations have to be wrong? No. So therefore, depending upon your application, you choose which one is proper. Right? If you have 7, you want to get one more, or if you want to double it, then it's 4 and 4. You know, you want to work in quarters, and it's 6 and 2. So depending upon your purpose, you will choose one of the explanations. So if you're trying to establish Krishna's supremacy and the devotee's submission to him, and then how the devotee sees that difference, then you use that one. Krishna's great, so they see themselves as very small. So therefore anything they see is a problem. That's one way of applying it. If you're applying it on how inside my head technically I'm going to break this down and apply it, then you use another. So because one person has said one thing and another person says another, they're not contradictory. They're different angles of the same thing. This is a very, very important thing to understand. Because otherwise, then one will spend one's whole life not being satisfied because he sees different answers, and he'll spend his time going around and asking different people and having fun finding out what different thing they said, and then saying, oh, you say this, but that guy said that.
I don't see the contradiction.
So
I can understand this one, but I cannot understand another.
Yeah, point is how do you say something was bad? right? Somebody goes up and let us say you see somebody suddenly slap somebody on the back real hard. And then immediately you think why they're beating. But then you find out that person got something caught in his throat and was choking on it, so the other person whacked him on the back. So how do you decide what's good and bad? Generally by the externals. Therefore, the acharyas will see externals of how they behave, and because they're humble, they will naturally put to that that it is improper motive. That is due to some bad quality that they acted in that way, though it wasn't at all. So that was the point. Does that make some sense? You know? You also have to understand as they are going to such a fine degree that technically there is nothing wrong, because the fineness in which they are observing it, they will find a fault. Because in the material world, everything's at fault. There's nothing perfectly good in this world, there's nothing perfectly bad. So you can't find anything that has, in the conditioned stage, it has no fault to it. There's no such thing. You want to create a sabji, then you must destroy a potato. Right? Potato had a shape. You've destroyed that shape. You've used the mode of ignorance to cook. Right? You've used the mode of passion to cook. But your motive was goodness. So therefore, that's what's looked at, not the externals. But if you want to look, you can see the faults in it. So the acharyas, because of the humility, are able to look at it in such a way that they can see faults, while we have a tendency to look for the good. But with others, we can find faults. But with ourselves, generally, you know, we're quite liberal. You know? Is that okay? We should probably end here. Grantara Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki, Sainata Gaurav Srimad.